coming out on this rainy night and battling the Virginia Tech football traffic. We weren't aware of that. We tend to work our revolve all of our classes around NASCAR. You know, we know about those weekends, big X's on the calendar. Stay away from those weekends. Thursday night football games throw us off, though. So we appreciate you coming out, and particularly in this rain. Kelsey Johnson is assistant professor in the astronomy department at the University of Virginia. She also serves as adjunct assistant astronomer at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Ms. Johnson is a recipient of the NSF Career Award, recipient of the University of Virginia FEST Fest Award, recipient of the UVA Excellent and Diversity Fellowship, and winner of the prestigious Hubble, Spitzer, and NSF and Jansky Fellowships. This fall, she received the David and Lucille Packard Foundation Fellowship Award, which was $650,000 for projects. She'll talk with you about that. It was significant. It was a huge honor. She served on numerous national and international advisory committees. She's a graduate of Carleton College and has her PhD and MS from the University of Colorado. So we really appreciate her coming down and spending time with us this evening. We would also like to thank the Roanoke Valley Astronomical Society for being here, as well as the Roanoke Valley Governor School students. We're glad you're here for the question and answers. We always have such interesting dialogue afterwards, and that is part of the reason why we offer this. WVTF FM Radio, our colleagues from there are here to podcast this. They're going to, the Engaging the Mind site makes all of their lectures available in podcasts, and they are taking care of that tonight. So thank you all for coming out.
Thank you, Kathy.
I know this isn't what you want to see. It is a pleasure to be here, despite all these things about weather. Wonderful to see how many people came out despite the rain. I am thankful for the rain, right? We need the rain. No one's going to complain about the rain, except for the driving. Now, the thing about the rain, it's not so good for stargazing. Okay. And normally, if it were clear, I would challenge you all to go outside after this lecture and look at the night sky. Now, you could do that, but I don't think you'll be very impressed. So, you all have to promise me now, okay, I'm not going to talk, that the next time you have a chance and there's a beautiful, clear night, go outside and look at the sky. It's a simple thing to do, but marvel at the night sky. The universe is an amazing place, an amazing place. Now, the thing is, you kind of want to go someplace a little bit darker than maybe downtown Roanoke, but that's not so hard to do in this part of the country. You only have to drive for 10 minutes in any direction here and you're on the mountain. So, you all have to promise me, before I'll talk, you're going to go and marvel at the night sky. Okay, so everyone's going to marvel at the night sky. So, you're going to go out, you're going to marvel at the night sky. And mostly, what you're going to see with your own eyes are stars. Not a surprise. And when you look at the stars, you're actually just looking at a tiny little pocket of our own galaxy. That's all we can see with our own eyes, even though we can see this amazing stuff in space. And you look at the stars, and they pretty much don't change from night to night. Occasionally a satellite comes through. Every once in a while, it'll catch a meteor shower. So it's really tempting to think that stars have been around forever, and they'll be around forever, and they're never born, and they never die. They're just eternal. And on a human time scale, that's pretty much true. But they're not. They are born, and they do die, and this turns out to really be critically important for our universe, and actually critically important for us to actually be here today. We would not be here if it weren't for stars living, and more importantly, dying. And we'll get to that. So stars are born and they die, and they are part of what I want to call the cosmic ecosystem. You've heard about ecosystems on the planet. Let's talk about the ecosystems in space. And to start with, what I want you to focus on is this loop, right in the middle of this plot. And the thing to know about this loop is that if the stars weren't here, this loop would not happen. And this is a critical loop. So let me walk you through it just a little bit. Stars are born out of huge clouds, huge, enormous clouds of gas and dust. Really, and I do mean dust. So the next time you think that your house is dirty, think about how much dust would be required to make a star. Maybe you won't feel quite so bad. Now, I will gladly volunteer to donate some of the dust from my house to this process if I could. And I'm happy to say my mother-in-law is actually in the audience tonight. She knows how dusty my house is. But stars are born out of huge clouds of gas and dust. Who would have thought? Really huge clouds of gas and dust. The stars are formed. They mostly live their lives uneventfully. We'll get to when they don't. And they die. They spit out their material back into space and make more clouds of gas and dust. And more stars are born. And they die. And you go around and around and around. But other stuff gets shot off of this too. For example, when stars die, they spit out heavy elements into space. And by heavy elements, I mean anything heavier than hydrogen or helium on the periodic table, if you can remember back to your college or high school chemistry class. So carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all of these things we need to exist come from stars dying. Kind of important, okay, especially to us. So the stars die, they spit out this stuff. This stuff makes us, it makes our food, it makes our cars, it makes our atmosphere. It also makes planets. Okay, very important. The other thing stars do is they provide the energy to support life on planets. We wouldn't be able to support life in the solar system if it weren't for our own sun. So this cosmic ecosystem is very important, and stars play a very important role in that ecosystem. And I think we will all agree that life, well, life as we know it, is probably pretty important. Okay, now here's the thing. None of the rest of this cycle would happen without stars. And that is a pretty profound statement, and let me tell you why. If we were to make gravity a little bit weaker, or the strong force that attracts nuclear particles together a little bit weaker, or a little bit stronger, all of this would get messed up. If gravity were too weak, stars would never form. Our universe would be very different. So the fact that we have this cycle in our universe is really a profound philosophical statement. Now, our own sun is actually pretty dull. No one likes to be told that they're dull, but we really are pretty dull. But in the universe, being dull is a good thing. Exciting things happen in the universe, but they usually cause a whole lot of destruction. So our sun is pretty dull. It's going to live for a whole bunch more billion years, eventually kind of puff off its outer layers. Now, sure, it's going to puff up and engulf the Earth and incinerate everything on the planet, but as far as a star goes, that's not actually very exciting. Okay. There are stars, however, that are much more massive than the sun, and these stars that are more massive than the sun are really the ones that pop a wallop, and they live their lives really fast. With stars, it's live fast, die young. The massive stars eat through their fuel at a phenomenal rate, and then they die. And because they're so massive, they die in spectacular ways. So here again, this is the life cycle now of a massive star. So not a star like the sun. We start with clouds of gas and dust. The clouds of gas and dust contract from gravity and form stars. The stars live their lives, but now it's a massive star, so it lives its life really fast. Our sun will live for billions and billions of years. A massive star might only live a couple million years, which is the blink of an eye on a cosmic timescale. We can think of what was happening on our planet a million years ago. You can open a geology textbook or a paleontology textbook and look at what was happening on our planet a million years ago. It's not very long. So massive stars go through this cycle really fast, and that's what drives the universe. So the massive star, it's born, it evolves, it dies, and then it does this cool stuff. Low-mass stars, when they die, they just kind of fizzle out. Massive stars explode. They shoot out supernova remnants. They make black holes. They make neutron stars and pulsars. And if they completely get rid of themselves, their entire star will be disrupted and disseminated back into the interstellar space. So low-mass stars are great. We need them to live. High-mass stars are what drive the universe. So it's high-mass stars that we really need to know about. This is sort of a cartoon, and it is a simulation of what would happen in this cosmic cycle. So let me just tell you a little bit about what you're going to see. Here you have a lot of stars, right? Here's a star. It's about to die. When it dies, it will explode. And we've got this cloud of stuff here. When the star explodes, you're going to see it smack into this cloud and make more stars. So this is part of the cosmic cycle. Then the stars that are born in this cloud, we won't see it here, but they will go on and do the same thing. I just think this is a cool movie, and I want an excuse to show it anyway. Movies are always fun. So here we go. Look at that. Smacks into the cloud. Be like popcorn going off here. And so this cloud becomes a star-forming nursery. And this is pretty realistic. Now, this is not a physics simulation. It is just a cartoon simulation. But it gives a pretty good picture of what happens in part of this cosmic ecosystem. All right, so star formation, I hope I have convinced you, is really important. I even argue in my proposals that give me this money that star formation is the most important physical process in the universe. Second only, maybe, to gravitational clouds, because if you don't have gravity, you can't form stars. So, okay, I'll defer to gravity, but star formation is really important. Now, the problem with star formation, this is an example of star formation in the Orion Nebula, which is actually one of the most spectacular objects in the winter sky. For those of you who are amateur astronomers and never use telescopes, this is a great object. I'm sure you've seen it. The Trapezium cluster here, you can see just trivially, it's gorgeous. So if you have access to a telescope in the winter, go and look at this. This is an example of a star-forming nursery. Now, the thing about star formation, really important, right? I convinced you all, phenomenally important. Good, because then you'll, you know, if you were on the NSF board, you'd give me money. but it happens deep in these dark molecular clouds, really hard to see. Okay? We can't just look in there with normal telescopes. Very, very hard to probe these star-forming regions. Very hard to figure out what is going on in star formation. So as a result, we don't understand it at all. Massive stars in particular. We have some theories. They all have holes in them. We have unbelievable debates at our meetings. You know, the less evidence you have, the more outrageous the debates at the meetings is the way I found it to go. But star formation is really poorly understood. Now, there is one thing we know, however. One very solid fact. And that is that pretty much all stars form in clusters. They're all born in families. Stars are just not born by themselves. This is an example of a cluster. It's actually, by my standards, a pretty wimpy cluster, but it's a cluster, and it's really pretty. So one of the things we do know is that stars form in clusters. So if we want to understand star formation, we've got to understand how they form in clusters, which is what brings me into sort of my own research topic. Ah, I forgot. I have another movie. This is really cool. Now, this is a simulation. Now, when I say simulation, what I mean is that the people who did this, Matthew Bateman at Exeter, they take all the laws of physics that they can and put them into their computer and apply them to a situation and see what happens. Okay, so that means it's physically realistic. This is our idea. As astrophysicists think things will happen, this is physically realistic. Now, what you see here is a huge cloud of gas, essentially uniform, spherical. Nothing stands out about it. Definitely symmetric. You can see some random fluctuations across it. They allowed sort of a random amount of noise on top of it, if you will. Now watch what happens as time goes on. You can see time is in the upper right-hand corner there. It starts at zero. Immediately these filaments form, filaments as sheets. They start interacting gravitationally. The denser parts get denser and denser. Just like the rich get richer and richer, the denser parts get denser and denser. Because they have more gravity, they can attract more stuff in. Rotate it around a little bit, and pretty soon you'll start to see some stars popping out. There's our first star. Two stars, look at that. Look at them whip around each other. They get flung out. More form and fall in. Pretty soon a star with a disc gets flung out here. I love that. That's my favorite part of the whole movie, is watching that. It's a proto-solar system. It is a star about to form a solar system getting kicked out of this cluster. Pretty soon, I think it'll recenter down there on that proto-solar system we're seeing face on. So you can imagine if a planet is trying to form in this environment, the kind of havoc that's being wreaked, okay? If you have stars flying by you in a cluster and you're trying to keep a disk to make a planet, you are so screwed. But our sun formed in a cluster. Wasn't a real intense cluster, but it was a cluster. Our sun had siblings. They've long since left home and moved away, but we had siblings when we were born. So with what we started with is a uniform sphere of gas. Now look what we have. We have a cluster of stars. And that's essentially, to zeroth order, what we think happens. And a whole bunch of details are glossed over here. But it's basically what we think happens. And so the one thing I want you to remember, if nothing else, is that stars form in clusters. They are born in families. Sometimes the families aren't so tightly knit. Sometimes they are. Here is an example of a very large family. This is a globular cluster. And globular clusters are, I think, the most fascinating objects in the universe. Okay, if they're spherical, well, it'd be kind of cool if they maybe had more structure visually. But, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. These objects are amazing. We have these, they live all around our galaxy. About 150 of them live around our galaxy. They are almost as old as the universe itself. Globular clusters, by and large, around our galaxy are older than 10 billion years. They were born at the time galaxies themselves were forming. That's pretty cool in and of itself. So those of you who are part of the local astronomical society, I'm sure you've seen globular clusters in your telescopes. They're beautiful objects in the sky. I think M15 is up right now. M15 is one of my favorite globulars. There are millions of stars in this cluster. Millions! Now let me put that in some perspective. I mean, million is a big number. I mean, I certainly don't deal with a million of anything on a daily basis. Maybe some of you do, in which case I want to shake your hand after the meeting. But this is, you know, a million stars packed into a really small place. Now let me put this in perspective so you can have a better sense of what I mean. If our sun were here, in the universe as it is, the closest star would be somewhere in the outside of this image. So in our universe as it is, where we have two stars, we would have a million. Imagine what the night sky would look like. Imagine how that might change your worldview. So when you do go out, as you promised, on a dark night and look at the night sky, think what would happen if instead we lived in a globular cluster. Very, very different. Okay, so they're very old. Almost as old as the universe itself. They are very small. They are 10 light years in size. Now, what I mean by light year is that if light started out here, it would head on its way, and it would take it 10 years at the speed of light to get over here. Now, of course, by our human standards, that is big. By cosmological standards, that is puny. Okay, so these are small by cosmological standards. 10 light years in size, a million or more stars, phenomenal objects. How the heck were they formed? Theoretically, these are really hard to form. It is very hard to get enough material smashed into a hard enough volume to do this. very, very hard. Yet, we know in the beginning of the universe they were formed prolifically. We see them everywhere. So what happened at the beginning of the universe? Well, here is our first clue. Now, I know the answer. So it's your first clue. Okay. This is an artist's rendition of our galaxy. If you haven't thought about it before, we can't actually leave our galaxy and take a picture of it. So if you ever see a picture of our galaxy, someone's lying to you. Okay, we can't actually take a picture of our galaxy. The first probes we sent out into space in the 1970s have only just now left the solar system. And that was 30 odd years ago. Okay, we cannot leave our galaxy and take a picture. So this is an artist's rendition. And to orient you a little bit, our sun lives right about here in one of the spiral arms. We think it's in what's called the Orion spiral arm. Here is the central or nuclear region. Here now, if you take the galaxy face on and you flip it on its side, this is what it looks like. So our sun here is about right here. Here's the central nuclear region. Now, just for reference, in case you're curious, the distance from the center of our galaxy to us is about 26,000 light years. Okay, so again, if light started here, marching out to us out here in the suburbs of the galaxy, it would take 26,000 years. So when we look at the center of the galaxy, we are seeing what happened 26,000 years ago. Okay, so if this were a city, this would be downtown. This would be the suburbs. We are way out in the suburbs. Okay, we're in tract housing, really. This is the Hicks. This is the country, way out in the country. And this is where globular cluster lives. And that's what these little cotton balls are supposed to be. These are globular clusters, and they live out in the boonies around the galaxy. We have about 150 of them around our galaxy. As far away as we can see, around every massive galaxy, same thing. Oodles and oodles of these globular clusters, all out in the halo. Now that's odd. Why are they in the halo? Nothing else is in the halo. Okay, that's the first clue. That tells us that however it was that globular clusters formed, it was different than what caused the rest of the galaxy to form. Because they're different places. They're totally spatially separate. So that's clue number one. Clue number two, I alluded to before, and that is to get this kind of matter condensed into this kind of space is really hard. To have incredible pressures and amazing densities over really huge volumes to get this to happen. And I should point out, if we want the globular cluster to live for 10 billion years, you really have to do a good job at this. Because you know what? Clusters evaporate. Isn't that odd? They evaporate. They lose their stars. The stars gravitationally interact and get kicked out. And so to make one dense enough that it lives the age of the universe is really hard. So let me show you a movie now of a cluster evaporating. So here is a simulation, again, of a globular cluster. Now, simulation, I'll remind you, means they put in the laws of physics insofar as they can and let them go. So here's a globular cluster. You see all the stars around it. And I'm going to let this movie play. First, it just kind of looks like a swarm of bees. Right? Stars are just kind of orbiting around each other. Every once in a while, you can track one that gets kicked out. More often than not, this cluster is preferentially losing stars that are getting kicked out. Nothing happens for a long time. And suddenly, it will lose enough stars, it'll just poof, go away. Here we go. But always kind of leaves me with a melancholy feeling when I'm left like in the deep darkness of space staring at a couple stars. But that's what happens. So if we want them to live for 10 billion years, they've got to be really dense in the center. Okay, really hard to do in terms of the universe to get that to happen. So our clues, they live in the halos of galaxies, which means they were formed by something different than the way the rest of the galaxy was formed. And they require extreme physical conditions, that's the second clue, in order to create densities and pressures that are high enough. Here's the answer. You throw galaxies together. What do you think about that? Okay, now you're thinking, okay, Kelsey, where did you get your PhD? It's true. This is, I think, isn't this breathtaking? This is an image of two galaxies colliding. They're colliding. One's here. This is the nuclear region of one. Here's the other one. They're both getting kind of messed up. That's what happens when you collide with a galaxy. Something this extreme we usually call a train wreck, but they are colliding. And you see all the spots of light you see in here? You might be tempted to think those are stars. They're not. Those are baby clusters. You don't see a single individual star in this image. All you can see are clusters, and they are forming like gangbusters. So this is how we think you form globular clusters. You throw galaxies together. And it turns out that you can actually still do this in the universe today. You just have to find two galaxies to throw together. Now this is getting harder and harder and harder, because every time you throw two galaxies together where you had two, now you have one. Okay, so you lose the number of galaxies to throw together, and the universe is getting bigger. So the space between galaxies is growing and growing and growing, as the galaxies themselves are growing and growing and growing, because they're accreting and they're merging. So we end up with these huge, giant, elliptical galaxies that are, you know, 10, 15, 100 galaxies that got smushed together. So galaxy collisions like this are becoming more rare in the universe today, but they do still happen. And when they happen, we can look at this process and say, oh my goodness, I see a globular cluster forming. I didn't think they had formed for 10 billion years. Now, if I can watch it forming here, that tells me something about the physical conditions at the beginning of the universe, when they were forming all the time, everywhere, around every galaxy. Now, when we see them as babies, baby globular clusters, we call them superstar clusters. This has a lot of history behind it you don't want to know about, lots of scientific debates. We couldn't call them globular clusters for like a decade because half the community didn't believe they possibly could be. So we're stuck with this name, superstar clusters. Now they're really super, I think so. So baby globular clusters are superstar clusters, and that is what I study. All right, now, galaxies colliding, how common really could that be? Space is really big, right? Kind of hard. It turns out, remember I told you stars are born in families? Galaxies are actually pretty darn social too, and they interact all the time. This is one of my favorite examples. This is called a compact group of galaxies. This is Seyfert's sextet, so that means it has six galaxies. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This actually, it turns out, isn't in the group. It's way in the background, and it's just projection that you think it's in the group. It's not actually part of it. So it's really should be Seyfert's quintet, but we didn't know when we named it. So now it's Seyfert's sextet. But you've got five galaxies in the process of merging all at once. And this is not uncommon. Wild. This is wild, wild stuff. So it turns out galaxies, our social interactions are common. Galaxies are cannibalistic. Our galaxy, I don't know if you know this, we eat baby galaxies all the time. We are pretty cruel. We have shredded all kinds of low-mass galaxies. We are the bully. And in a couple billion years, we're going to collide with the Andromeda Galaxy, which is another big spiral. That'll be fun. Lots of cool stuff. There are so many ways you can die in astronomy. Fortunately, they're all really far away. Lots of fun ways to die in space. Okay, so galaxy interactions are common. They're becoming less common today, though. So here is a history of the universe, cartoon style, and let me walk you through this. This was created by the good folks at the Hubble Space Telescope, so it features the Hubble Space Telescope here. This is what Hubble looks like if you've never seen a picture of it. And the idea is that light takes time to travel. So the farther away we look, the farther back we're looking in time. Because if I started here, you know, at the Big Bang, the light that I emitted is going to take me almost 14 billion years to make it here. So when we get that light today, we are looking almost 14 billion years into the past. Now, We don't have to look that far away. So here is the Hubble Space Telescope, and here's the universe basically as it is today. This is light we're getting from galaxies just a couple million years ago. This light that we're getting today from the nearby galaxies in the universe left those galaxies when there was already stuff going on Earth. We look farther away, though, and we look farther and farther back in time. So we get to here, and we have gone back billions and billions of years. So we're looking back billions and billions of years in time, and galaxies start to get different. They don't look like they look today. They are messed up. They live in groups. None of them look normal. They're weird, blobby messes. But that's what happened. So in the history of the universe, galaxies used to collide all the time. All the time. So it holds together. Globular clusters require something weird to happen to the galaxy. It can't be what happened normally to the galaxy because they live in a different place in the galaxy. And extreme conditions. And we know they were formed prolifically back at the beginning of the universe, which makes sense because galaxies were colliding all the time. So that's essentially the whole train of thought and the answer to the question. Now, I still have to get money though, right? I can't pretend like the whole thing is solved or no one's going to give me money. That's the great thing about science, right? Every question you ask, of course you get 10 more questions. You can never actually get to the bottom of anything. Well, we do sometimes get to the bottom of something, but we always have more questions because the universe, it turns out, is really big. And there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in it, most of which we don't understand. So, my whole argument is that globular clusters can give us information about the early universe, especially if we can see them forming today. Well, is that really true? In principle, yes. But remember, star formation is very, very hard to observe. So the problem, again, is that star formation happens in these deep, dark, thick, dense molecular clouds. Very hard to observe. But we have tricks up our sleeve. We've been doing this for a while. Astronomy is the oldest science. So one of our tricks, this is a trick we've only been able to really utilize in the last decade or so, and that is other wavelengths outside of optical light. Now, when I say optical light, what I mean is the tiny little chunk of the whole rainbow of light, the whole electromagnetic spectrum that you can see with your eyes, which is really small. So here is the view of a star-forming cloud in optical light. You can see we have thick, dark, dense dust clouds. This black stuff you see here, it's not a lack of stars. It's not a void. It's thick dust. Kind of spooky. This is a little bubble being blown by stars that were just born. Stars blow bubbles. You know what? They have winds. Crazy stuff. So these newly born stars are blowing this bubble. Here's the thick, dark, dense material out of which it's formed. And what this movie is going to do is transition from optical light through the near infrared, so slightly longer wavelengths, out to what we call the thermal infrared, where we can really start to see through stuff. So maybe you've seen sort of military spy movies where they're trying to see who's in the building and they can look through the building and see the heat signature of people. It's the same thing. Okay, we're looking through the dust. See the heat signatures of the stars. This movie, by the way, was put together by the Spitzer Science Center. Spitzer is the last of NASA's four great observatories. It's undergoing its last year of cold right now. So here we go. Near infrared, starting to see through the cloud. Barely see the cloud. Isn't that awesome? I love that. It just looks so ghostly and ethereal. And we're seeing now, we see the cloud itself because the cloud used to be dark. Remember, we started, it was dark. Thick, dark, dense dust. But it turns out the dust is actually pretty warm, so we get its heat signature. So we get the heat signature from the dust, and we get to look through it at the stars that are formed. Now the bubble that we used to see where there was light, now it's dark. No heat signature from that bubble. I just think this is spectacular. And these bright pink objects here, these are all stars that were just born yesterday, basically. So the important point is that if we want to understand star formation, we have to use other tools. We can't just use optical telescopes. We have to go to long wavelengths. And this is an example of what we can do in the infrared. So here is the electromagnetic spectrum laid out in all of its wavelengths. Here's our chunk. Makes you feel kind of wimpy, huh? Small. But what would we see, really, if our eyes had developed to see gamma rays? Not much on Earth naturally produces gamma rays. Gamma ray eyes would not be very useful. On the other hand, lots of stuff produces radio waves, but if we wanted to be able to see stuff in radio light with any degree of detail, our eyes would have to be essentially the size of a state. Also not so practical. So, however, when we observe star formation, visible light, not so useful. So we use all of these longer wavelengths, infrared, microwave, which is sometimes also called the submillimeter, and the radio. It gets longer and longer and longer. And the longer wavelengths can go through stuff. You get radio reception in your house because radio waves can go through your wall. So here is an example of one of the best radio telescopes in the world, and it is in Green Bank, West Virginia, just a few hours away. It is 16 million pounds. Okay, here we go with millions again. 16 million pounds. You're supposed to go, ooh. Good. This is the largest steerable telescope. In fact, it's the largest steerable anything anywhere on the planet. Pretty cool, huh? An amazing technological feat. Its predecessor, do any of you remember its predecessor? Oh, I wish I brought the movie. Its predecessor, one night, out of nowhere, collapsed. And the picture from the morning after is really stunning. And that's really to underscore that building telescopes of this size is non-trivial. Now, what do I mean by this size? You know, you've seen one telescope, you've seen them all. This is not like the radio antenna in your backyard. Okay, do you see this little square rectangle thing up there? That's a building. To give you a sense of scale, this telescope is enormous. And if you have not been up there, I strongly encourage you to go. It's just a few hours away, and they have a fabulous science center, like an honest-to-God real science center. It's not just like a hole in the wall with a put your coin in the thing that rolls down. It's a real science center. Now, I try to bring my research groups up there as often as I can. In fact, I'm bringing my undergraduate class up there next weekend. So here is a picture of me with my group a couple of years ago up on the dish. So it was great fun to go up there if you're not afraid of heights. It was wickedly bright. None of us could see, but it was really cool. It was really, really cool. So you can see the edge of the telescope here. Of course, it wasn't tipped over when we were standing on it. It was stowed up. They do have safety requirements there. And everything in this room, by the way, we went up to that room. Everything has to be Velcroed down and strapped down. You can't just have stuff flying around when they're moving the telescope. That wouldn't be good. So go up there and see it sometime if you have a chance. Really, it's one of the best radio telescopes in the world in your backyard. Here is another of the world-class radio telescopes. This is the Very Large Array. Mostly it was made famous to the general public by the movie Contact. Does anyone see Contact? Raise your hand. Good. That's one of my favorite movies ever. You know, the coolest thing about Contact is that it was written by Carl Sagan, who is a real, or was, he died of cancer about a decade ago, a real astronomer, and so it's actually sort of scientifically accurate, which is not true of every science fiction movie out there. And the first time I went to the VLA, I got to wear Jodie Foster's hard hat. Okay, so here is the VLA. It is about 30 years old, and at 30 years, it is still the best radio telescope in the world. And it has not been upgraded, ever. Doesn't that blow your mind that anything can still be the best in the world after 30 years? Amazing. It is now getting a very well-deserved upgrade. But it's even without the upgrade, it's the best radio telescope in the world. So this is down in New Mexico. You will see that most of the antenna are pointed at the same place in the sky. That's good. You'll see this one It's doing its own thing down there. Now, that's a shot of realism. It takes a lot to maintain these antennas. Something is always going to break on one of them. So one of them's always down for maintenance, and you just live with it. So that's a shot of realism, but it is spectacular down there. And if you like the Southwest, I really encourage you to go out. Okay, so that is the Very Large Array, an amazing facility that I use all the time for my research, federally funded, so this is what your tax dollars go to. You know what I learned the other week? This is so cool. You know, I'm often, you know, you give people the price tag of observing facilities and their jaws drop. These are expensive things. There's no doubt about it. If you think about what it really means, you know what I learned the other week? I learned that every year Americans spend $4 billion on Halloween. Fascinating where our priorities are. Anyway, this didn't cost $4 billion. It was actually only about $30 million when it was built, which is pretty cheap by astronomical standards for an instrument that's been around for 30 years and is still cutting edge. Now, the big thing coming down the pipe is ULMA. Every astronomer in the world right now is scrambling for ULMA. ULMA stands for the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. It is, or will be when it's done, the most expensive, technologically advanced telescope ever on the surface of the planet. $1 billion price tag. Okay, this is where usually people's jaws drop, but now I told you we spent $4 billion on Halloween, so maybe you're thinking, if I had spent... Okay, $1 billion price tag. It is an international collaboration with lots of different partners. The U.S. has a good chunk of that. But it is going to really blow everything else out of the water, without question. It is at an altitude of about 17,000 feet. How many of you have been on top of a 14,000-foot mountain? I realize we're on the East Coast, but okay. Some of you, if this were a more interactive room, I would have you tell me how you felt. You know how you felt. You can imagine how you would feel if you were to do it. Back when I did my PhD in Colorado, before I had kids, we used to do things like go up mountains. Right about 10,000 feet, oh, bad headaches. Not feeling so good, can't really breathe. You know, I forced myself up the rest of the way because I really didn't want anyone to see me as a wuss, but it sucked. Okay, 14,000 feet sucks. The telescopes in Hawaii on Mauna Kea are at 14,000 feet. They don't let you sleep overnight there. You have to go back down to 10,000 feet to sleep. You can't be in a telescope with less than two people because people do stupid things. Lack of oxygen, bad. Especially when you're operating a billion-dollar facility. Okay, it's like being drunk and being given $1 billion to play with. Woohoo! Here we go. Very, very, very high. 17,000 feet is very high. Fortunately, astronomers, for the most part, won't actually go to the site. It will be operated remotely, but the rooms that are at the site will be oxygenated for very good reasons. Here, again, we have reality. Okay. One of the antennae is always going to be doing its own thing. It's just what happens. You deal with it. Maintenance has to happen or everything would break. Now, what is the best thing about ALMA? It is going to be 20 times more sensitive than the VLA, and hopefully I've already convinced you that the VLA is pretty darn good. It is going to kick the butt of HST, okay, 10 times the resolution. Now, those of you who are here from the high school, probably HST has been around your whole life. You don't really think much of it. Now, it may not be around much longer. We're keeping our fingers crossed. But those of us who are slightly older, remember HST going up and the huge impact it made. You know, when I was growing up and taking astronomy classes, the images I looked at, I look back at them now and I'm like, ugh, what was that? HST has spoiled us. Well, we deserve it, so it's not spoiled if you deserve it, but HST has been amazing, and this is going to be 10 times better than HST. Now, what's really important about it, however, despite all of these other properties, is that the part of the electromagnetic spectrum that ALMA will be able to observe is virtually unexplored. It's the last unexplored part of the electromagnetic spectrum left. Now you might ask why it's the last unexplored part of the electromagnetic spectrum left. And the reason is it's really hard and really expensive, which is why it's taken us a very long time to do it and this costs $1 billion. But it's a huge chunk of the spectrum and we have essentially no idea what's there. Think about that. That is really cool. So as soon as this telescope comes on, it's like discoveries are going to be falling from the sky. That's why we're scrambling to get ready for it. We are scrambling because we have so much work to do. And we don't even know. We have science questions ready. But I guarantee you, a year from the time ALMA goes on, the science questions will be completely different because we'll learn new and completely unexpected things that we had no idea we were going to see. And suddenly we're going to have to, you know, really scramble to get our act together and figure out what's going on. So completely unexplored. Kind of like, you know, I feel like Star Trek. Now, what is particularly cool about ALMA, for those of us who live here in the good Commonwealth of Virginia, is that the ALMA Science Center is operated by the headquarters of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, which are in Charlottesville, Virginia. Pretty awesome. Okay, this is the best, most expensive, most technologically advanced telescope ever on the planet, and the headquarters are in Virginia. Okay, don't take that for granted. Really important. Okay, so what I hope I've left you with is that star formation is important, and it's really cool, and it makes really pretty pictures. The future is really bright. For these long wavelengths, we're just starting to tap into it. There are a whole suite of facilities that have just come online now and are coming online in the next decade. So we are really excited. It's a great time to be doing this research. And if we're just in heaven, we'd love this. So I have one final slide, and then I will stop. Thank you for your attention. I'm more than happy to take questions now, and I think Althea will moderate that. And, of course, you are welcome to hang around afterward.
And if you could stand at the podium, we weren't able to get everything that you said tonight.
Okay.
Questions?
I'll be so sad if you don't ask questions. I really will.
Well, it's an easy one. Just where was ALMA located?
ALMA. Oh, I missed that. Shoot. That is a very good question. ALMA is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, and it is located in the Atacama Desert in Chile.
And what's the wavelength?
The wavelength is the microwave, otherwise known as the submillimeter, and that starts at about 100 microns and longward. So from about 100 microns to about a millimeter, if you can sort of process them.
Is there a possibility this will shed some light on what dark energy is?
Ooh, dark energy. Who here has heard of dark energy? This is an educated group. We are so stumped by dark energy that any new telescope facility that comes online is going to do a lot to try to understand dark energy. Will it really unravel what's going on? I don't know. Dark energy, for those of you who aren't aware of it, although it looks like most of you are, not very long ago, astronomers did this experiment, and they thought they knew the answer. And the experiment was the following. We know the universe is expanding, but we think, you know, because there's stuff in the universe, and that stuff has gravity, that the gravity will be slowing it down. So it's expanding, but it ought to be slowing down. It ought to be decelerating. So they went out and they wanted to figure out, well, how fast is the universe decelerating? Because that will tell us if it's going to collapse eventually into a big crunch or if it's going to expand forever. So they went out to do the experiment, and their goal was to find out how fast the universe is decelerating. And you know what they found? It's accelerating. Totally unexpected. And we don't have a clue what's going on. Very weird. So we've called this dark energy. There are some wild physical theories for it. Will ALMA shed light on it? I sure hope so, but I have no idea. That's a very long-winded answer to your question, but it's such a fascinating topic.
I believe you mentioned that the ALMA will be 10 times the resolution of the HST, which I'm guessing is the Hubble Space Telescope.
I'm sorry, yes, you're right.
I have heard that the atmosphere of Earth actually distorts many images, and that's what makes the Hubble much better than anything on the Earth. How will ALMA solve that problem?
Brilliant question. You have put together two contradicting pieces of information, and you are rightfully asking this question. So yes, in optical and infrared wavelengths, the atmosphere has turbulent cells in it that move around. And when those turbulent cells move around, they bounce the light around with them, which is why, if you've ever thought about it, when you look at the night sky, which you promised to do, stars twinkle. It's the light moving around. Now, if you're taking an image of those stars, that light is moving around on your detector and it blurs it out. That's why we had to send HST into space, was to get above the atmosphere. Now, the answer to your question is that it turns out that at these long wavelengths, at microwave millimeter radio wavelengths, the atmosphere doesn't actually really matter. It does matter, which is why ALMA is at 17,000 feet, but it matters not because of the resolution, it matters more because of the water vapor. And the water vapor completely, water vapor is good, right? We're having a drought, we want water vapor. Water vapor completely absorbs all of those wavelengths of light. And so we get above the atmosphere with ALMA to get above the water vapor, which is why it's a nice high, dry site. But in terms of resolution at radio wavelengths, it actually doesn't have an impact. It's optical infrared wavelengths that matters. Very good question, though.
I guess I was curious to know at what point contact is related to science, and at what point, in your opinion, does it break with what you would consider to be a scientifically accurate thing?
Good question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Yes, I'll be a good girl. I can't stand still. Contact. Where contact is really accurate, it's accurate in the way the scientific process works. It's accurate in the way the politics work. indeed. And it is accurate in the sense that that is the way SETI, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, works. SETI is a scientific experiment looking for signs of extraterrestrial intelligence. It's not being done by some kooks down the road with their own telescope. These are hardcore, dyed-in-the-wool scientists looking for signs of extraterrestrial intelligence in a very scientific way. And that is real. SETI is out there. Some of you probably have the SETI at home computer monitor saver program thing, which is brilliant. Stay here. And so contact is very accurate in that way, and SETI is entirely funded by private money, and I'm not putting out a call for that. I'm not part of SETI. You can give it money if you want to. SETI is entirely funded by private money, which is also what happened in contact. In fact, SETI was congressionally funded. It got approval for congressional funding, I think, for a decade, and a year into that decade, they cut the funding. Now, where does contact deviate from science? Probably about the point where she goes through the wormhole. Now, it only deviates from science in the sense that we don't know that can happen. But the way that Carl Sagan portrayed it as happening is entirely plausible. It's not outside the realm of scientific plausibility, even if it's still science fiction. So when she actually goes through the wormhole, that's where it deviates from what we know to be able to do in the universe. But in terms of, I think, Carl Sagan's treatment of how we would interact with an extraterrestrial intelligence and what that experience would be like, I think he was, you know, as on the mark as you can be. He was a phenomenal writer. If any of you have ever read some of his books, they're really, really enlightening. Good, I'll stand here.
Regarding the formation of the globular clusters, we had a picture of two galaxies colliding, and in that picture it showed large different regions of large cluster formation.
Yes.
Regions. Are there pictures available that have globular clusters in them that are at different stages of their development, all the way out to the final matter?
That is a great question. And let me just rephrase the question in case you didn't hear it.
are there images of galaxies available that we can see the entire evolutionary sequence of a globular cluster from birth to death? I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but I think that's the gist of your question. And the answer is sort of. There are a few cases where we think we can do it, but the number of objects available isn't great. And part of the reason for that is that when they are in the process of being born, it's really fast, and it's really hard to catch them when that's happening. And so to actually catch them when they're in their natal environments is hard to do, and it's very rare. So we see lots and lots of galaxies with adolescent clusters and middle-aged clusters and old-age clusters, but we see very, very few galaxies with natal clusters, adolescent clusters, middle-aged clusters, old-age clusters. And so it's hard to catch all of them at once. Yeah, this is my mother-in-law. This is my spirit.
When you said
that's a very good question. When they are born very fast, on astronomical scales, less than 500,000 years. It's hard to put stringent limits on it because the data is very hard to get and they're so rare, but less than 500,000 years, which on astronomical timescales is, you know, a blink of an eye. So really, really fast. I think, did you want to say more? That's right. It's a question of being pointed in the right place at the right time, because it would be lovely to have the luxury to sit here for 500,000 years and watch something happen. Science hasn't quite gotten that far. So it's luck. Luck and educated guesses.
When we're told that most galaxies have a 2% mass black hole in the center. You've got a colliding galaxy that causes globulars. I guess my question is, does that preclude an intermediate mass black hole in the center of a globular because of the way the kinematics of the collision? I mean, can you talk about that some?
Excellent. So most galaxies in the universe, by the way, have black holes in their centers. We have a black hole in our center, if you didn't know that. A pretty cool one. It's a massive black hole. There are different categories of black holes, and I'll turn this off. It's distracting. But globular clusters, because of their stellar densities and the interactions and their dense cores with stars constantly doing stuff, they always have intermediate black holes in them. And we see evidence for them in various ways, but we're pretty sure there are intermediate black holes in many, many globular clusters. Was that what you were asking? Okay.
Does that mean all or many? I'm just curious.
Well, we can never say all because we can never observe all.
Fair enough.
But statistically, it's consistent with all. Okay.
Other question.
There's one up here.
Do we know what might keep a globular cluster from imploding, from just collapsing into the black hole?
Oh, good question. I love that question. When I do my section on globular clusters in class, I always get that question. And I forgot to say it here, so thank you for bringing it up. So the way globular clusters work, you remember I showed you in the movie, and it's like a beehive? Now, think about our solar system. Another way to ask that question, it's exactly the same question with different words in it. Why doesn't the Earth fall into the sun? It's the same thing. It's just bigger with more stars. And so the stars, sometimes they collide, and sometimes those collisions have enough of a dampening effect that the star will come in and kind of get stuck. But mostly, they orbit in like a comet. They come in from a long way out, they orbit in, get whipped around the center of mass of the cluster, and get whipped back out. And so they can't collapse because they can't get rid of their angular momentum. If they could get rid of their angular momentum, they could collapse. But there's this whole conservation of angular momentum thing that keeps everything up in physics. And so that's really the issue, is conservation of angular momentum, if that's a physics term people are okay with.
So they are rotating them?
They, as a system, are not necessarily rotating. You know, the million stars in the system are not necessarily all doing the same rotation at the same time, but any individual star is rotating about the center of mass. It just, you might have one star doing this and one star doing that.
I just wanted to ask a question about dark matter and our understanding of the halo sitting in a dark, I mean, the GC sitting in a dark matter halo.
Yes.
And then the second part of that question relates to Mons and modified. And to ask if anybody's done any sort of experiments about the movement of GCs around the center of the galaxy, and is dark matter in peril, I guess?
Oh, boy, is dark matter in peril? You guys are asking really good ones. Okay, primer on dark matter, for those of you who aren't familiar with it. Dark matter, dark energy, weird things. When astronomers say dark matter, what they mean is that when we go out and observe stuff, through gravity, we detect a lot of mass that should be there because it has a gravitational effect, and we don't see it. We can't account for it with black holes. We can't account for it with planets. We can't account for it with dust. We can't account for it with anything we know of. We think it's some kind of weird substance. We think. Okay? So we call it dark matter, and we sweep it under a rug, and a lot of people try to study it. Now, dark matter isn't a huge issue on small spatial scales. It's not going to affect you in your daily life. I promise you're not going to go home and run into a clump of dark matter. But on really large scales, galaxy-sized scales, cluster of galaxy-sized scales, dark matter is a really big thing. It can be the dominant gravitational force. Now, along comes this upstart and says, you know what? I don't think that Einstein and Newton were right. And along comes the theory called MOND, which is modified Newtonian dynamics. And MOND takes the good old gravitational stuff that Newton did and tweaks it a little bit, tries to work it in so it's consistent with Einstein and general relativity, which is no small feat. And it actually looks pretty good. It's a beautiful theory. It predicts that gravity actually changes its strength at different distances. Now, is it testable? Barely. And as it happens, we just had a colloquium in Charlottesville about 2 weeks ago by an astronomer by the name of Bob Dickman, who has just taken up the directorship at the Very Large Array. And he spent his last year studying MOND and whether or not it could be tested with globular clusters in exactly the way you are saying. And his results were completely inconclusive. And he gave a colloquium on this. He got us all jazzed up. You know, he's working us up, the whole colloquium. And he gets to his conclusion. He's like, eh. So I think the jury is still out. There is, however, in terms of MOND, I don't know if you are familiar with, it sounds like you guys are way educated on astronomy. If you have heard of the Bullitt Cluster, if you have not heard of the Bullitt Cluster, you can go home and look it up. Google it, look it up in Wikipedia, find it in the Astronomical Journal if you want. But the Bullitt Cluster put some pretty stringent restraints on whether or not MOND could be true. But that's sort of the cutting edge of the field, and I think no one really knows what's going on with gravity. But gravity is important. It turns, you know, do you know this? Gravity is the weakest force. Gravity is puny. Pretty cool. So talk to your physics teacher about that one. Okay.
Impression from galaxies that they are like whirlpools.
Yeah.
If there's a black hole in the center, is it like positive and negative on each side? Does the whirlpool spin out one side? Is that probably what Arthur Clarke has in mind for Star 8 in 2001?
Oh, that would be so fun. Galaxies do look like whirlpools, and in fact, there is one of the most spectacular systems. By system, scientists have the worst terms. By system, I mean galaxy interacting with stuff. It's called the Whirlpool Galaxy, and it looks like a whirlpool, and it's beautiful. And the way galaxies work is that they do all, at least massive galaxies, they do all have black holes in the center, as far as we can tell. But stars, for the most part, just orbit around it, just like we orbit around the sun. Occasionally, there's enough drag or friction of some kind. Now, I don't mean friction like rug burn friction. I mean friction like gravitational friction. If you go by something that has gravity, it'll slow you down. So occasionally, if you're around a black hole and there's enough friction to slow you down, you will spiral in and go into the black hole because you've lost your angular momentum through friction. Now, is the whole galaxy doing that? No. It turns out it's actually really, really hard to fall into a black hole, which is good news, right? Of all the cool ways you can die in astronomy, it's really hard to fall into a black hole. But it would be cool because you would be trapped at the event horizon and watch the rest of the universe play out before your very eyes, just before you died, or maybe just after you died. But I guess the short answer... I'm so bad at short answers because this stuff is so fun to talk about. The short answer is no. Everything isn't sort of going down a drain the way we think of whirlpools, at least not in terms of astronomy. Rather, it's just orbiting a center. And its orbital angular momentum is keeping it up. If everything spontaneously lost its angular momentum, it would go down the drain immediately.
You mentioned that the Milky Way was going to collide with the Andromeda Galaxy. What exactly would happen if a globular cluster formed as we collided with it?
That would be so cool. I would get a lot more funding. What would happen with a globular, in terms of globular cluster formation, if we collide with Andromeda? Now, galaxies colliding does sound pretty catastrophic. And in some senses, it is. But one thing you have to keep in mind is that stars, for the most part, are actually pretty far apart after they leave home when they're born. You know, they go far away. So the space between stars is pretty big. So if my hands are two galaxies colliding, the stars, for the most part, will basically pass right through each other. There'll be a little bit of gravitational interaction, and maybe every once in a while one will smack into each other, but that will be rare. So in terms of galaxies colliding, you know, we and our sun are actually probably pretty safe. The worst thing that probably will happen is a star will make a close flyby and gravitationally tweak the solar system and we'll get kicked out. So much fun. Why don't we get more funding? Now, what would happen with globular cluster formation? So the stars go right through each other. What sticks and what smacks is the gas. If you try to smack a cloud of gas and dust into another cloud of gas and dust, it can't pass through it. And so it is very possible that when the Milky Way and Andromeda collide in a few billion years, that the really gas-rich areas in the galaxy, when they hit each other, will form maybe not globular clusters, which are really crazy, but they might form pretty good clusters. So maybe not super star clusters, but, you know, decent clusters. All right, you all have been wonderful. Thank you.
Please take a moment and fill out your feedback cards. Thank you for coming tonight.
Good questions.
Silly question, but I just want to get you going. What is a globular star cluster?
A globular star cluster is, in my opinion, one of the most amazing objects in the universe. They are ancient. They are almost as old as the universe itself, 10 billion years old or more. They live everywhere in the halo of our galaxy. Our galaxy has about 150 of them. So they're ancient. They are ubiquitous. they are extremely small, about 10 light years across, which is, you know, big by our standards, but small by astronomical standards. And in this small space, they pack a million stars or more, which is amazing. And by comparison to our own star and our own local universe, it would blow us out of the water.
What can we learn about our early universe by studying them?
What can we learn about our early universe? Well, it turns out that globular clusters were really formed prolifically in the early universe. And up until recently, we really had no idea how. So if we can study their formation anywhere, we can learn about the physical conditions in the early universe and what was happening in the universe at the time galaxies themselves were actually forming.
And what can we learn about our future?
What can we learn about our future? Oh, goodness.
Which looks bleak if you fast forward, what, billions of years?
Billions of years. Many things can go wrong astronomically in billions of years. There are all kinds of cool ways to die. We will probably ourselves never encounter a globular cluster because we live in the disk of a galaxy, so we're pretty safe. Globular clusters mostly live out in the boonies. In a couple billion years, our galaxy will collide with the Andromeda galaxy, which is the other big galaxy in our local universe. And when our two galaxies collide, probably we will form some globular clusters. Now, we have no way of predicting where they will form at this point. Probably they will form. Whether or not they will affect us if we still exist here on Earth in a couple billion years, really hard to say.
One last question. What do you hope your audience took away from this? Your educated audience, too.
It was a very educated audience. What I hope they took away is that the universe is amazing.
Fair enough. Thank you.